Up where they walk, up where they run, up where they paint my blood and puss soaked body in the sun.
Yeah. Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry Maxday, and each week I, my co-host and our guest propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. Peter Pan said that to die would be an awfully big adventure, and if that were true, how many of us would look forward to death that little bit more if instead of just slipping into an endless sleep, the Grim Reaper shows up not with a scythe, but with a treasure map, sealed with a scarlet ribbon and uttering only the words, "Impossible Prism." Our first clue. We assemble a team around us. There's Hank, our ramshackle drunkard of a pilot with a heart of gold. Asim, the friendly and not at all racially insensitive, vaguely ethnic sidekick with a heart of gold. Madeline Mindy Montgomery Sinclair, the rich heiress with a passion for the outdoors, with a heart of gold. And our faithful old hound Screwball, the mutt with a nose for glory, and a heart of gold. We set off on a round-the-world expedition, dodging zeppelins over Nazi Germany, battling not-at-all racially insensitive pygmies in the deepest jungles of the Spice Isles, defy ravenous alligators and swarms of killer locusts, and dice with disaster as we scramble through a crumbling temple to find the X marking the spot on that map. We stand in a specific shaft of light before a specific statue and utter the words the Reaper gave us, "Impossible Prism." And from the shadows, a doctor emerges and says, "I'm sorry, sir. You've got only seconds to live. You're suffering from coronary ossification, otherwise known as a heart of gold." And with me, the daisy to my push, the bucket to my kick, and the mortal coil to my shuffle, it's Ben Vanderveld.
Hello.
Hiya.
Have you been huffing furniture polish and then playing Return to Monkey Island?
I've just eaten a Jules Verne novel.
I mean, I really enjoyed whatever happened in the past 2 minutes of our lives.
I've just been on my own for the last 5 hours. And I'll be honest, had to write that with about 3 minutes before you arrived.
Don't let people behind the curtain. What's Impossible Prism? That feels like a reference I should know.
It's just two words. I picked adjective and exotic sounding noun and put them together.
I thought that was an incredible reference to like a caper movie from the 1940s.
Maybe it is. Listeners, write in with your obscure 1940s caper films.
Well, I sort of worry that Impossible Prism might be the trigger word for all of our listeners, because I don't know if you know, but all of our listeners are Manchurian candidates.
Not at all racially insensitive Manchurian candidates.
No, and all of them are Manchurian candidates with a heart of gold as well. So my concern is that I've now said Impossible Prism so many times, and I don't know whether it's odd or even, so yeah. I don't know whether I've accidentally deactivated all of our listeners, or I just keep... I'm clearly deactivating them, then reactivating them, then deactivating them again.
Okay, we'll so intermittently during the podcast, just to be on the safe side, say the words Impossible Prism.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, well, because the real worry is that when this gets released next Monday, is that you and me may wake up with, you know, all of our listeners at our window.
By our bedsides.
Yeah.
The dream will have finally come true.
It's taken us 80 plus episodes to finally get a snaking crocodile of trivia nerds to attend our bedsides.
Snaking crocodile of trivia nerds is, I think, the collective noun. Yeah.
You've got a Wikipedia page.
I know.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which it's really weird. There was a few appeared on the same day for a few of us weirdos, and we don't know who did it. And everyone blames each other.
Oh, I like it. Yeah. So I reckon that you've got a Manchurian candidate in your group as well.
Does that mean that we could do each other's?
We could do each. Let's totally do
or,
that.
No, come on. The more fun thing is, any listener who wants to write our Wikipedia page.
Oh, do you know what you're doing? My God.
It's going to be the most fun thing.
Yes.
But when we appear on Graham Norton and we go, "So how did you guys get into duet bassooning?" Yeah.
they check it. I got banned. I got an IP banned from Wikipedia from a work IP as well, because I kept editing myself as a time traveller and appearing in different things.
Let's find out whether your Wikipedia entry is true or not. So our guest this week has made a name for himself as a stand-up and storyteller whose shows are renowned for their imagination, anarchy and hilarity, containing stories such as a long-term tete-a-tete with an evil crow and imagining himself as the entire universe. Having taken solo shows around the world from Edinburgh to Australia, he's also performed at some of the UK's biggest festivals, including Glastonbury, Bestival and Latitude. Whilst not performing, he is also a director, writer and collaborator with the award-nominated Weirdos Collective, and also the co-founder of equally award-nominated live improvised comedy show Comedian Cinema Club, which has grown into house residencies in London, Brighton and LA. He is a weird, wonderful, woolly man who, when he's not being a comedian, also works as the levelled-up Pokemon of me. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Matt Hyten.
Oh, that is lovely. What was lovely about the intro is I know from those copy and paste jobs which bits I wrote, which bits were nice surprises. That was very lovely. Hi guys,
you're a proper film lover. Like in the way that I know you're into your music, but in the way that I'm a music nerd, that I can name obscure B-sides and know what colour underpants John Lennon was wearing on a Wednesday in 1965.
What were they?
Green. Okay. But that was...
You're the time traveller.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I time travelled back into John Lennon's crotch.
Past John Lennon.
The time-travelling underpants salesman.
Yeah, it's...
Audrey Niffenegger's next novel.
Yeah. And the thing you'll find these... briefs are really going to be popular in the next year.
No, and the follow-up to that should be A Brief History of Time.
Oh, yes. Look at that. Or worked into an actual joke.
At the end of Mr. Y Front.
Oh, very good.
Let's just do this for an hour.
Yeah, screw the podcast. Let's get this plot hammered down. Yeah.
It's like they've got to time travel back to China in the 19th century to take part in the Boxer Shorts Rebellion.
Hello.
Manchuria, perhaps?
Impossible prism.
That's just the same as flicking it on and off again.
Oh, there, that's a good point.
Twice. You have to just do it once back where we started.
No, that's the Control-Alt-Delete.
Okay.
That happened on them. You are, I don't know how we ended up here, you're like a proper film buff, and that you don't just watch, like, Marvel or the Oscar-nominated stuff. I can imagine you down at the BFI on a Tuesday night.
Yeah, I like
watching odds and sods.
I like all sorts, but like everything. Like I love blockbusters. I love big, like summer releases. But yeah, then sometimes I'll find an obscure, like exploitation film from the 70s and go, oh, let's give this a go. Quite often me and my fiancée nearly split up because I can't live with her when I find out she's not watched a certain film.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
But what's the most shocking film she hadn't seen?
Weirdly, I think it saved our relationship when I made her watch Gremlins because she'd never seen Gremlins a few years ago. And Katie is renowned in our house for... if it was made before she was born, she's going to hate it. But she loved Gremlins. I think that was when I knew I was going to propose.
A friend of mine is going through watching all of the Star Wars films at the moment. She had never seen any of them, and her boyfriend is making her watch them. The thing that's most disappointing me is that she's only watched the first two, and she's gone, yeah, it's quite good. I'm like, no, it gets better because she started at episode one.
Chronological.
Yes.
As in,
she already thinks, no, this is quite good. Stop it. It's basically a bad episode of 90210 set in space for the first three films.
Yeah, it's like, I think Hayden Christensen's got real depth. I think he's basically a space Brando.
My favourite thing about that whole film is that it feels like it was definitely the first draft, and they just went, no, you're George Lucas, you can do whatever you like. And no one said, have an editor.
That's exactly how I feel about, and I will not rant about this on another podcast, but that's how I feel about Prometheus. I feel like they handed in the first draft, and he went, yeah, sure, I'll just make this look futuristic. Go.
We always ask our guests what they're worst at in the world. Matt, what would you say you're the worst at?
I think I'm the worst at finding my own keys. I genuinely can look at the exact spot my keys are in the house.
Okay.
And not see them.
Are you good at finding other people's keys?
No.
Okay, just keys in general.
But specifically mine, I can put them down on this table.
Yeah.
And then I'll forget about it. And then I'll search the entire house before I come back to this table. Like, I'm so bad at it, to the fact that I am now into my third month of hand physio, because I couldn't find my keys, got locked in the house, and had to jump off my balcony to get to a radio recording. And have severe tendonitis and ligament damage.
See, you thought the corollary to you saying you're bad at finding your own keys was he's good at finding other people's keys. My head went to, I'm bad at finding my keys, can you please search my pockets for my keys, as a really creepy chat apply. I mean, I can't find them, they must be in one of them. Have at ye.
Yeah. I don't know, I keep reaching.
It's a chub.
Oh dear.
Okay, I need to control alt delete Ben for a second.
You do also, I'm well aware that we have a fair few listeners who are not from the United Kingdom. Is chub a international reference for all things related to key?
The question of the week is chub.
This week we are talking about the world's worst death scene, and this is the first topic that we are doing an episode on, thanks to a suggestion from one of our Patreon donors. Is it Catherine Pugh?
It is Catherine Pugh.
Hi Catherine.
We've got Matt. If that's all right.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Catherine. If it's not.
Yeah, I mean we asked Ron Howard, but he was busy. And we tried to exhume Bela Lugosi, and that didn't work either. So Matt was third on the list.
Didn't Bela Lugosi get buried in a Dracula costume?
Yes, he got buried in his Dracula costume.
Just because you said exhumed, I was like, oh, that's why my brain just went.
Having thought, I might shake off this role in a few years' time. Nope, leaned into it.
No, it's also so that when he does wake from the dead, he's ready to go.
Yeah, you've got to look
dressed for the job you want, not the job you have.
So, Ben, you're going to kick us off with some death scenes.
I'm going to start with some death scenes. So I first went into sort of myth and history, but it's all like the bits of like Greek history where you go, that must be made up.
Yeah.
So we'll start with a chap called Charondas, who is a Greek lawgiver from Sicily.
You do have to tell me that.
Yeah. I know, but just for the listeners, that's all.
Matt's party trick is naming all of the Greek lawgivers from Sicily in a minute.
Yeah, well, I read his
in a rap.
I read his Wikipedia page. He actually was his drinking partner.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And his squash partner. So Charondas, according to the historian Diodorus Siculus, this chap issued a law that anyone who brought weapons into the Greek assembly must be put to death. And one day, he arrived at the assembly after hunting in the countryside with a knife still attached to his belt. And honest to his word, in order to uphold his own law, he then committed suicide in front of the assembly.
Yeah, but doesn't that sort of create some sort of weird paradox where they're not allowed weapons in the assembly, but if someone brings weapons in, they have to be killed with the weapons that aren't allowed in the assembly.
So you take them out of the assembly and then kill them there.
No, okay, fine. No, and then the guy who did the killing walks back in and goes, he's dead, guys. Oh no, I'm still carrying the knife.
Is that a first Darwin Award there?
Can it be a Darwin Award several thousand years before evolution was invented?
I think evolution had been invented then. hadn't been discovered.
By who?
By a monkey. Sorry, you were right as well. A monkey god.
Yeah.
What, Hanuman invented evolution? Very clever. Don't mention that in the Patvad Gita. there's another account given by a chap called Diogenes Laertes about the Greek philosopher Heraclitus. And Heraclitus was said to have been devoured by dogs after smearing himself with cow manure in an attempt to cure his dropsy.
Yes.
Which is, that's a sentence that just keeps getting like better and better and better.
Some mothers do have him sort of sentence. Oh, I've got a dropsy.
Yeah, Heraclitus was the Frank Spencer of philosophers.
Or he went into hospital for his dropsy. You know the way people go to hospital and get a worse disease. He went into hospital for dropsy, but then he caught a case of ravenous dogs.
Yeah. Also, some mothers do have him theme tune play. Yeah.
One last one from Greek mythology. There's a chap called Empedocles of Acragas, also a Sicilian, and in one of his surviving poems, he declared himself to be a divine being, no longer mortal. Mm. How do you think he proved that he was no longer mortal and a divine being?
Jumped off something high, or stabbed himself, or drowned himself.
Fire.
A mixture of the two.
He drowned himself with fire.
Yeah, he jumped into Mount Etna. It was the almost famous equivalent of going, I am a golden god and I shall dive into a volcano.
Amazing.
That is great. Just whilst you're in the ancient Greece era, one of the best deaths I ever read about, and this is, again, it's supposedly on record as true, a man died laughing because he got his donkey drunk and he found it so funny, he ruptured himself laughing.
Yes, I read about that as well. I loved him. I loved him.
I loved my brother.
Yeah. I had a little foray into literature, and I found a novel called Ethan Frome.
Oh, are you reading now?
I am reading, yeah. I did. I mean, I looked through Sea Spot Run, but there's no death scenes in that.
Not just, in that version.
Not that one, yeah.
Sea Spot smells some manure rubbed on a Greek. A little bit of death in that.
Yeah, that's what they read at Eton Primary. So this is an American novel. It's set in a fictional town called Starkville, Massachusetts. heavy on the Restoration era naming. So he finds solace in a secret romance with a woman called Mattie Silver, who is his wife's younger cousin. However, because of the impossibility and immorality of marrying his new love, they propose one of the weirdest suicide pacts in literature.
Lovely.
They propose and then carry out to sled full speed into a tree.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with that.
Hang on. But did they have to do rock, paper, scissors to decide who was in front and who was in back of the sled? It's fine, Matty, you go in front.
I like to think they use a dog sled and just midway through they went, oh, this was an awful idea. Oh, God.
C-spot running.
Yes, C-spot running in Massachusetts. But then when the Massachusetts police force come down, they're just kind of like, what happened here? There's dead dogs, dead couple, Greeks everywhere. But I ended up going down the really unpleasant hole. I started looking at snuff films.
Oh, no, Ben.
Silly boy.
But before we got on there, I looked up something beforehand, which is sort of where snuff films sort of came from, something called a Mondo film. A Mondo film is an exploitation documentary film, sort of resembling a pseudo-documentary, and it's often got loads of taboo subjects intercut next to each other in really quick succession. The original, and they're named after an original film called Mondo Carne, which means a dog's world, which is like a light Italian profanity.
It's dog heavy, this one, isn't it?
It is dog heavy. Also, I originally read that as Mondo Cane rather than Mondo Carne. And I'm just going to read to you about like what happens in Mondo Carne, because it sounds fascinating. So it's all like little vignettes cut together, I think, to sort of show the absurdity of the world. So at the beginning, there's a scene of a dog being dragged into a dog pound filled with barking dogs. Then it cuts to Italy, where a statue dedicated to Rudolph Valentino is. Then it cuts to America, an Italian actor has his shirt torn off by his fans. Then to New Guinea, there's manhunting. Then to bikini-clad girls wooing US sailors on the Riviera. Then to New Guinea, where pigs are slaughtered for a long-awaited feast. To California, where pet owners mourn their beloved pet cemetery. Then to Taipei, where dogs are butchered and skinned alive for their meat. Then in Italy, chicks are painted for Easter. In France, geese are force-fed for foie gras. It goes on and on and on and on. And the final thing is it concludes with a cargo cult in Port Moresby, New Guinea. So it's this really odd mix of, like, shocking imagery.
And the producers of Prometheus says, we'll do it!
Yeah.
So, but in space.
Well, you say that. But, like, the Mondo genre took off, and so there were... There's all sorts of films, and the way that you could put Carry On before a subject.
60s, it takes off, isn't it?
Yeah. So there was like Mondo Bizarro, Mondo Hollywood, Mondo Keyhole, which I presume is Lloyd Grossman going, and who would live on a dog meat farm like this?
And they're also the sort of collage style. I suppose.
It's called the Exquisite Corpse Style, which is named after a surrealist word game invented by the surrealist artist André Breton. Mm. And it's basically like the game Consequences. But the surrealists would play it with sentences, and the first one that they ever came up with was the sentence, in English, the exquisite corpse shall drink the new wine. Mm-hmm. And it's meant to be sort of absurdist and nonsensical, but also saying something about the world we're in. But because it was all based on really quite shocking imagery, as we get to the 70s and the 80s, the imagery becomes more shocking and more scary. Mm-hmm. And so there's quite a famous movie called The Faces of Death. And they basically use fake footage, but also some real found footage to show things like autopsies, suicides, and accidents. And the best description of it, there's a critic called Christopher Kulik who said, if you can get through Faces of Death, then you can get through just about anything. Feel free to judge yourself, though.
Wow.
But there are a series of six controversial Japanese horror films from the 80s and 90s called the Guinea Pig films.
Yes.
Yes.
I've never had the want or the balls to watch any of them.
They sound horrible. I mean, firstly, like, The Guinea Pig sounds maybe a little bit scary as a horror film, but in Japanese it is called, it's Guinea Pigu.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And it's, well, because I remember...
Steve from In the Night Garden.
Yeah. Yeah, and what happens in the night garden stays in the night garden with him. I do need to tell you about the first two Guinea Pig films to set up for the one I'm going to choose. They're not nice. So listeners of a nervous disposition should have turned off 20 minutes ago.
Impossible Prism.
Well done. They are designed to look like snuff films. The video is grainy and unsteady. The first one is called The Devil's Experiment, or in Japanese, Unabridged Agony. Sorry, that was also in English, not in Japanese, but that's the literal
Japanese
translation.
Is so good, Ben. It was only like me speaking English.
It's breathtaking, isn't it? So it revolves around a group of men who kidnap and graphically torture a young woman in as many ways as possible as part of an experiment on the human body's threshold of pain. It's a bit sort of Marquis de Sade.
Hang on, Ben, this isn't a film. This is your diary.
January the 14th. Pick up Marie at Marylebone High Street.
It is a bit Marquis de Sade or Story of O.
Yeah. The second one is called Flower of Flesh and Blood, and this one's even weirder. The plot revolves around a man dressed as a samurai kidnapping a woman, drugging her, and taking her to a home. He then proceeds to dismember her and finally adds her body parts to an extensive collection.
This is an absolute cult classic. Like, in terms of, like, people reference this film all the time, to the point I have a friend who is in a punk band called Flowers of Flesh and Blood.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've never heard of it before.
Whatever about the rest of the film, as soon as you say the words, a man kidnaps a woman, I just go, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, exactly. It's because if it's like a psychological thriller involving a kidnapping, sad, but there's something interesting going on. But where it's just essentially torture porn.
Yeah.
Guinea Pig 3, Shudder, the man who doesn't die, is nuts. So it revolves around a scene in which a man cuts himself and is surprised that he can't feel any pain. And when he realises this, he starts cutting himself more and more and more until he realises he can't die. And he invites a co-worker to his home.
At Mount Etna.
And a dog who they skin and eat and then let the dog's eyeballs watch what's happening. And then basically the man just gets more and more dismembered but remains alive. And at the end, he's decapitated and his head remains on a table in his room. Still alive.
And Monty Python went, right, I see a sketch.
Yes. But my selection for the world's worst death scene is from Mermaid in a Manhole.
Mermaid the 80s in a classic. Manhole, I know,
yeah,
I know.
Yeah, exactly. For those keeping
B-sides.
For this keeping up, this is The Guinea Pig 6. This talks about an artist who is trying to cope with the recent death of his wife. One day, whilst visiting the sewers beneath the streets of Okinawa, and that is the less weird element of this sentence, he comes across a mermaid that he once met as a child when the sewers used to be a large river. This mermaid is now stranded and stuck in the sewers. He decides to sit down and paint her, but she starts crying in agony. That's when the painter notices that she's got boils growing all over her body due to being stuck in the sewers for so long and having contracted infections. And so, because he's a nice man, the artist picks her up and takes her back home, but then she starts to descend into even more agony and she develops lacerations and begins to bleed. I don't know about you guys, but if I brought home my mermaidy muse to my art studio and she was in pain, I don't know, take her to a vet? But he doesn't. He then uses the blood and pus that is emanating from her wounds to paint her portrait as she then dies before him.
Yeah, that's logic.
I don't know, Disney's Little Mermaid could have taken a different angle on the whole story.
Up where they walk, up where they run, up where they paint my blood and puss soak body in the sun.
Yeah.
Weirdly though, that is grim. Quite close to The Shape of Water.
Yeah. God,
yes,
it is.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I imagine that's a movie that Guillermo del Toro will definitely have watched, isn't it? Yeah,
it's like, how do I make a film that's somewhere between Mermaid in a Manhole and Splash? When you said worst death scene, I thought filmically worst, like the worst acted, the worst, just the worst all-round film experience.
That seems fair.
Like, if we, because I did look into the what I thought was the worst death scene of all time, and there is one that really resonates with me that I remember from the film, and it's a horrible film, Irreversible, if any of you have seen it. It is a film with Monica Bellucci. It's early noughties. It made half of the audience at Cannes leave or vomit, and it is a anxiety-inducing nightmare. Wow. It is horrific. They're to the point where the filmmakers, they've coded it with things like infrasound and wobbly transitions, so you feel physically sick.
Oh, no.
And there is, I believe, it's a 13-minute rape scene, which is brutally stripped back and awful, and it works like Memento. So it works backwards, and it starts with these two guys killing this guy, and it works back through the film, and the reason is it's this woman's boyfriend and her ex-boyfriend are hunting this guy down who raped this Monica Bellucci in an alley. I was studying film at the time, and I was like, yeah, this is going to be gritty and real. Never picked up that DVD again. Never watched it again. Never want to, but it's seared in like a memory.
It's well, it's important as well, because there's I can't remember I read it, but about how Hollywood has taken away the power of what, say, a gunshot wound is. Because we think a gunshot wound is, pew, out the other side, little hole. Whereas actually it's, no, it shatters a part of your body and all the shrapnel explodes inside you.
Well, Ben, tangenting perfectly onto my next film I'm going to talk about, it's a, this has become internet famous. It's a 70s film.
Yes.
You know, I'm going to say Karate Girl.
Karate Girl. Or,
have you guys talked about this before?
No, I've seen it.
Have you seen it? Have you seen it, Ben?
No.
This minute of absolute glory. It is by far one of the most entertaining deaths you'll ever see, because every choice in this this scene is just mind-blowing. So yeah, it's a 70s film. I think it's Turkish, if
it
I
is,
remember
yes.
rightly.
The and Turkish name is Karateci Kids.
Oh, no, I have seen it in that case. I didn't realise it was called Karate Girl.
Yeah. It's mind-blowingly bad. Like, so the next few choices I'm going to give, they're all, they've all got the element of Garth Marenghi to them. Like, they're all just these terrible B-movies that are sort of either, cheap to make or straight to VHS. But, like, this one scene, I to my shame, I've never seen the full film. I just know this scene from so many references, from so many things. And I think it is one of the most glorious things ever, ever put onto cinema. Like, if you are listening to the podcast now,
you literally just need to Google worst death scene.
It is
the first 10 results on Google.
Yeah, and it's just amazing, because they've obviously, they filmed this woman shooting this man, and they filmed her with the gun, and then they filmed him reacting and dying, and
throwing himself around his bedroom.
But they, for some reason, they put it in slow motion. Yeah. There's times where they've obviously just repeated the shot of her shooting the gun, so there's no impact wound. Yeah. And she's like, and it's like a minute and a half long, and it is glorious. And I think as far as worst, as in worst acted deaths, that's the worst death.
My favourite thing about it is he spends, like, his entire death looking for things to knock over.
Yeah. There's one point where
there's a bedside cabinet I can knock a thing off. Oh, there's a picture on the wall I can hit. But you also occasionally clock him, like, looking for a thing to land on.
There's a bit where he realises he's got blood on his hands. Yeah. So he turns around to face the wall and sort of raises his arms and just presses himself against the wall. Like, and it's all still in slow motion and cutting back to this woman. And it's beautiful. So there's the worst death.
The actor, by the way, is called Bülent Kayabaş.
And I imagine he went on to big things after that.
I think
that.
He died a few years ago, but he became very very famous for in weird circumstances.
His death was reported to take several hours after a fatal gunshot. So that would be up there. There's two more. I would be remiss in my duty if we didn't mention that death from The Room. See, I'm not a big fan of The Room. Like, I love a shit movie. There's something about when you watch a film where people are overly enjoying the badness. Because I'll say it, there's bits of the room that have redeeming qualities. Very few,
the
but
credits.
But like the room is it's renowned for being bad. But that suicide scene, it's just. Again, it's the performance. He's clearly going through a shot looking for things to knock off.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, even though you know it's filmed on a set and you know it's him acting, it feels like when you're a kid and you're making a film with your friends or like shooting a video, but you know your parents are upstairs.
Yeah.
So he's kind of not giving it his all. So he's like, oh my God. No. And it's like 5 minutes long. And at the end, he shoots himself and he's like, you can see him breathing still and twitching. And like Tommy Wiseau wrote it, and he just basically, what makes it beautiful is when his body's found and he's basically imagining how it would be if he actually died, like, oh my God, you killed him and stuff like that. It's up there with some of the worst bits of cinema. It's up there with Troll 2. It's like absolutely terrible, but it's still not the worst, in my opinion, the worst death scene. Because I genuinely think, and this, if you Google these lists, this always comes up. The Room will be in a lot of these worst death scenes. To really annoys me, Big Trouble in Little China, when one of the storms blows up, that's always makes a list, and I bloody love that film. I think people are wrong. But the best scene for me is in Basket Case 3, which is a 90s film. It comes from an 80s film. It's a cult classic. It's in that sort of VHS era of bad puppets and prosthetics kind of way. Basket Case, the premise of the film, it can only be conceived in the 80s. You'd never get away with it now. But it's basically about two brothers who were conjoined twins. One of them is normal and the other is essentially a testicle with arms. like this horrible, got these fangs and stuff like that. And they are out for revenge against the doctors who cut them apart as children. And that is the whole film, is them hunting down the doctors who did it. They do want to be separated. And it's violent, it's gory, and there's blood spraying everywhere. And it's just a bad... bad film,
but they got three out of it.
Well, they put this out in the early 80s, and the director Frank Henelotter, I think he's called, he has like a big hiatus now. He's done what's these other films he did, something like Frankenhooker, I think it is, or something like that. So you get an idea of his style.
A heartwarming family tale.
Yeah. So he's renowned for being a horror comedy director, but he wants to be known as an exploitation director because it's got more accolades now. It's seen as more credible. But yeah, he has a hiatus in the 90s, like when the VHS boom happens and all these video nasties are coming out. He makes Basket Case 2 and Basket Case 3, The Progeny. I've never seen Basket Case 2. All I know is that at the end of the first film, the twins fall, and it's supposedly they survive, and they're picked up by this house of freaks who are also freaks, and they all look like baddies from Power Rangers, as if someone's broke into the Power Rangers lot and gone, yeah, we can use these costumes for this film, just shoved a bit of film. But Basket Case 3, The Progeny, it's an awful film. It opens with basically, so he's like this testicle with arms, and he gets his girlfriend who's the same sort of thing, and it opens with them fucking. And then it cuts to his brother, Dwayne, the normal one, and he's about to get it on with this woman who looks normal, but then she says, no, I'm pregnant. I've been pregnant for 6 years. And
wow.
It reveals she has this slit in her stomach where this worm comes out. And then he freaks out, and he freaks out so much he pushes her out of a window and dies. And the whole film then doesn't really reference that. I assume that's tying up loose ends from
the previous film.
Obviously. And then they have to go and deliver his brother Belial's babies in this house, and they basically get in trouble with the local law, and the local sheriff steal his babies, kill his wife, and Belial goes to the sheriff's office where his brother is now in prison, like the normal one, Dwayne. Just a little side note, there's a whole scene where the sheriff's daughter just decides to undress and be a dominatrix, but really, really weird, like, scene. But I'm gonna, like, I think you should watch this scene before we carry on. This scene is beautiful.
And there you go.
Wow. Okay, so just in case, because I'm not convinced that'll make the most compelling 2 minutes of podcasting, let's break it down.
Let's break down
what's happened there.
So, Belial, the conjoined twin, who is we shall now refer to as Krang, and if we cut this, he does look like Krang from the Turtles. He's come into the police department to find his lost babies slash avenge his dead partner. His brother is imprisoned there. And what happens? Let's talk you through it. First of all, he squeezes a man's neck so tightly, not only does his eyes pop out, his entire teeth pop out.
Yeah.
They pop right out of his face. That springs
like
two...
Like those old Play-Doh heads.
Yeah, exactly like that. So that springs the two deputies, who are obviously trained in policing, into action. One of them tries to sneak a gun, but gets caught by Belial, and he starts chewing the officer's face off. Meanwhile, the other trained officer reaches for his shotgun, but his nerves are so racked, guys. His nerves are so bad. The adrenaline's clearly giving him the shakes there. That's what the acting
spends the entire scene shaking with bullets in his hands.
I think 4 or 5 cutaways to him not being able to lower the shotgun. And he starts praying and going, Jesus Christ, oh my God, oh my God. When he finally gets the shotgun loaded, his deputy friend just is getting killed by not only having most of his face torn off, his entire head comes off.
Then,
and there's a lovely moment when that happens where the hands go, oh, my paws and whiskers, I've got no head.
Like those jazz hands. Like those inflatable guys you have outside garages.
Yeah.
We've got a sail on.
Or that chicken that stayed alive for 13 months. So then his is dead. The officer finally loads the shotgun and gets it pointed at Belial, which you think would be where he takes the shot. But still, the fear is crippling him. Mm. Belial leaps to him, starts chewing on his neck. Meanwhile, the sheriff's daughter has run to free Dwayne from the prison, the brother of Belial. Yeah. Thinking he can calm him down. She comes down. We know the shotgun's loaded, so again, it's an absolute Chekhov moment.
Yeah.
As they spring into the prison, he turns around, the shotgun then goes off, killing her.
Yeah.
Dwayne is just taking in the horror because he's pretty annoyed as well, so he's quite reveling in it. And he finally finishes off the last sheriff by twisting his head the entire way round, and he manages to flail for a few seconds, whatever that was.
But also, my favourite thing is when the sheriff's daughter dies, she falls and sits on one of Belial's progeny.
How could I forget that?
Like squashing a jacket potato.
Yeah, exactly that.
Firstly, I looked at people who died on stage. Famously, obviously, Tommy Cooper died on a programme ironically called Live at Her Majesty's, and the audience laughed for a minute, assuming that the fact that he was collapsing backwards into the curtain was part of the act. Even the girl who was doing the act with them thought it was a joke.
Yeah, it wasn't his head through the curtain.
It's very grim. And they obviously, it was being broadcast live on TV, so they cut to an ad break.
I didn't realise it was live on TV that he died.
Yeah, it was on TV.
Oh, God.
Molière died on stage in 1673 in his own play while playing the title role of the hypochondriac. Had a coughing fit. Yeah.
Oh, I feel all warm and fuzzy from that one.
Oh, there's a couple more of those. Matilda Pascali, who was an actress, died in 1873 when she was playing an angel because she was flown into a war by incompetent stagehands controlling the wires.
So literally like a blue tit going into a window pane.
Yep. And in 1971, Jerome Rodale, who was a longevity expert, appeared on the Dick Cavett Show, a chat show in America. And during his interview, he said, I'm going to live to be 100 unless I get hit by a car or something like that. And then the next guest, journalist and writer Pete Hamill, came out. And during his interview, Rodale slumped into the chair beside him in his mid-70s at the time, so he hadn't quite reached the 100. Pete Hamill turned to Dick Cavett and said, this looks bad. And they cut to an ad break. Actually, the programme was never aired. But that's pretty good. Someone who was on particularly to discuss his longevity.
That feels like someone who'd planned that.
Yes, that's
the sort of thing I'd do where I'd go, I'll say this, but I secretly took cyanide.
I am going out. I'll be remembered one way or the other. In 1987, the wrestler Mal King Kong Kirk died when Big Daddy landed on him. He did have an existing heart condition and that was the cause of death, but I can't imagine Big Daddy landing on you
would leave you with a heart.
And in 1996, the opera singer Richard Versal died at the Met Opera in New York during a performance of the Macropulos Case, a show about eternal life. just after he'd sung the line, "Too bad you can only live so long." Pretty classy way to go. In April 2014, the Globe remounted a production of Titus Andronicus, the Globe Theatre here in London, mounted a production of Titus Andronicus from the director Lucy Bailey. Titus Andronicus, very gruesome Shakespeare, probably the most gruesome Shakespearean show, described as a terrible cycle of mutilation, rape and murder. Titus at one point murders the sons of his rival Queen Tamora and feeds them to her in a pie, and five audience members during one performance of it dropped down in a faint.
They should watch Basket Case 3.
Yeah.
It's a hell of a thing to see that show. And also, do we go, this, the mind that made this is also the mind that made A Comedy of Errors.
Yeah.
It's like discovering that, like, I don't know, Ben Elton also made The Human Centipede.
Well, actually, onstage death was considered really crude in theatres around Shakespeare. Like, the British theatre was considered to be quite crude because it depicted a lot of deaths on stage. And actually, the further you go into Shakespeare plays, the more inventive ways he comes up with of killing people as well. They start as quite mundane, the odd stabbing here and there. And in fact, in 2016, the Royal and Derngate Theatre in Northampton mounted a production of a show called The Complete Deaths, directed by Tim Crouch, which depicted all 74 of Shakespeare's human deaths. The article I read this in included a little pie chart with all of the ways people died in Shakespeare.
Oh, great.
Wow. Who wants to hear these?
Yes, please.
There are 30 stabbings, 4 poisonings, 1 broken heart, 3 people stabbed then poisoned, 5 beheadings, 1 drowning, 1 smothered by a pillow, 2 hangings, 1 person of grief, 1 dismemberment then fire, 2 baked into a pie, 1 of indigestion, 1 buried up to the neck and starved, 1 throwing oneself away, 1 pursued by a bear, 1 drops dead, 1 of snake bite, 1 ripped apart by a mob, 1 blinded, 1 disappears, 1 from lack of sleep, and 1 from shame.
Wow, that is the most British death of all, yeah. That final one.
That's Una Barbas and Mark Antony's trusted lieutenant who betrays him. He defects to Octavian. Now, I do know that one person dies from eating hot coals. I think that might be the one that's listed as dying from indigestion in that list.
Yeah, Pepto-Bismol's not putting that fire out.
Yeah, yeah. Death on stage could be... You see it a lot in a tragedy. You know what the word tragedy means? Comes from the Greek words meaning goat song.
Oh, okay.
Apparently, the reasoning behind this is that often you would have sacrifice an animal, often a goat, and before that there would often be a performance of singing or dancing. So that would be the tragedy, the song before the death of a goat.
I remember seeing one of the first things I ever saw at the Edinburgh Fringe was an incredibly intense Polish theatre group who were called Song of the Goat.
Yeah, I think that's where it comes from.
Ah.
William McGonagall, we talked about this before. McGonagall, the world's worst poet, one of history's worst poets anyway, he was an actor in his time as well, and particularly enjoyed playing Macbeth, but often had to pay the theatre owners to let him do it because he was such a bad actor.
We've all done bringer gigs, haven't we? You know what that's like.
And one occasion he refused to die in the role of Macbeth because he was convinced the actor playing Macduff was trying to upstage him.
I like the idea though of doing Shakespeare plays but doing them like a gong show.
Yeah. More on that shortly, actually, Ben.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Sort of like a last man standing.
Oh, yes. But before we get to that, because that is going to be my choice, in March 2018 at Nova Hearts in Brazil, they were doing a performance of The Passion of the Christ in the town square. About 1,000 people were in the square to see Jesus crucified and the whole Passion play played out. And during the performance, the audience witnessed a man leap on stage and shout, "He was not going to let Jesus die." And he set about beating the actor that was playing the Roman soldier who was piercing Christ's side with a spear around the head with a motorcycle helmet.
What?
Yeah. The actor Samuel Rodriguez, luckily for him, was wearing a helmet himself because he was playing a Roman soldier, and so survived the blow. But there is footage of the guy doing it. The attacker was known to have mental health issues and was seized by the police. And after checking everyone was all right, the performance continued. The report I read noted that Jesus stayed calm and in character. And that, well, reading about an ancient Roman made me go to ancient Rome. Tertullian, a Roman writer, recorded that they actually used in some performances criminals to perform actual deaths in stage performances.
What?
So he writes of seeing criminals dressed up as Hercules before he was burned alive. And another occasion where criminals were made to play Attis. Now, Attis is a god who is castrated, so we can imagine what happened to those poor criminals.
That's incredible method acting.
Very, very strong work. There's also a story of someone playing Daedalus, so presumably being flown in on wires, being dropped down beside Nero and spattering him with blood.
Say what you will about the ancient Romans, they had a budget, didn't they?
Yeah. And no actors' equity.
Oh, yeah, they really held back the development of CGI, didn't they?
Yeah.
I've never fact-checked this, but I heard that in one of the Colosseums, they plugged all the holes, filled it with water, and had a cannon battle.
Yeah,
a
sea battle,
yeah. Which is insane.
What?
Yeah, they had a sea battle in one of the in the Colosseum. They flooded it.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So hang on. They put on an ancient Roman version of Waterworld.
Pretty much.
Yes. Right, fire up the time machine, Mark. We're going back and watch that.
Yeah. In ancient Egypt, for 2,000 years, every year, you could see the same play. These were the Abydos Passion Plays.
Christ, those producers, once they get an in, they just claw on.
We think the mousetrap's been going long.
That'll be Coronation Street as well. Yeah. 2,000 years down the line.
Well, this was a story of the death, burial and resurrection of Osiris. So Osiris in Egyptian mythology was a wise ruler who's murdered and his body is cut up and scattered. There are accounts of actors getting so into the role that they died of their wounds as they played it out. And there's another Egyptian performance on the Festival of Horus, which would depict the battle between Horus and Seth. Now, Seth is a god who's represented by a hippo. And so they had live hippos playing the role of Seth and slaughtered on stage.
No. That's what happens.
Ben is laughing at the idea of a live hippo being called Seth.
Yes, he is.
That's what happens when you create your gods by what animals you can see in your environment.
Yeah. But I'm going to go to a Shakespearean actor called Robert Coates, Ben. Robert Romeo Coates, as he was known to his fans. Coates was born in 1772, died in 1848. He died after being hit by a hansom cab outside the Theatre Royal in Drury Lane in London. And he was an eccentric, as all of the best of them were, and an amateur actor. He was the son of a wealthy sugar planter. He was born in Antigua and moved back to Britain and started acting in plays in Bath from 1809 onwards. He basically got in with a theatre manager there, who then discovered quite quickly he was not that good an actor. And he did that thing of, well, I'm rich, so I can afford to just put on the plays I want to and play the lead roles I want to play. He claimed to be England's best actor. He used his family money, as I say, to stage these productions, investing in bizarre costumes for himself. He liked playing roles, but he thought he could improve them a lot of the time. He thought particularly he could improve a lot of Shakespeare, so he would invent new dialogue, invent new scenes, and repeat his favourite bits, especially the death scenes of the characters he was playing, just in the same play over and over again if he thought it had gone particularly well, or as the audiences started to clamour for him to do it again, just on demand. The first time he played Romeo, he came on with this ridiculous, like, tight trousered costume with loads of diamonds all over it, which made walking extremely difficult, and at one point he bent over and split the seam of his trousers. He particularly loved playing Romeo, as I said. He came back in to try and crowbar open Juliet's tomb at one point.
Amazing.
He was so embarrassed the actress playing Juliet with his antics in this production that she clung to a pillar and refused to leave the stage with him. And this first performance as Romeo, he offered snuff to people in the box. He just thought, because he was standing on stage, he wasn't doing much, he turned around, do you want some? But his death scene is the best bit of all. When he knew he had to die, he took his hat off, placed it on the ground so he could use it as a pillow, took out a hanky and dusted the stage and then lay down in it. The audience were in fits of laughter, enjoyed it so much they called out encore, so he did it again.
Love it.
And they laughed again and wanted it again. He was only stopped doing it a third time by Juliet interrupting. So our candidates this week for the world's worst death scenes are Ben's suggestion of mermaid in a manhole, the puss paintings. Matt's suggestion of Basket Case 3, the progeny, where they basically raided all of Acme's best prosthetics. Or my suggestion of Robert Coates, who played the tragic death scene of Romeo again and again and again. Oh, I don't know. Because we've now watched Basket Case. We're not watching Mermaid.
God, no.
In a manhole. That sounds vile.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, actually horrible to watch, that's a really horrendous idea and would turn the stomach.
The thing is, I would say with it, there are almost certainly more stomach-churning scenes that I didn't go for because I wanted to keep this vaguely light and happy. It's that it's so weird as well. It's weirdly vile.
Yeah, that's true. Basket Case 3 has that, like overblown, everything about this is just stupid feeling where they've gone so far with the effects, cartoonish.
Also, I quite enjoyed it.
But it is terrible as well.
Yeah, it is bad and badly acted.
Like I say, he wants to be an exploitation. The reason I say it's the worst, because I know his career. So he wants to be an exploitation director, which means he wants to be taken quite seriously. Whereas he is forced into a comedy horror genre.
But on this podcast, my favourite thing is heroic failure. And people like, anyone who says, whose biog starts with, is an English eccentric, is generally going to make my ears prick up. And of the three, I would pay to watch Robert Coates any day.
I think I'd agree with that.
Yeah, that's fair, because, if in a Wikipedia entry it says English eccentric, oh, this is going to be fun. If it says, was it Japanese eccentric, it's like, right, where are the bodies buried?
Yeah. So I think I'm going to go with Robert Coates' repeated playings of Shakespearean death scenes as our world's worst death scene, because he's one of those that we love for being so bad.
Yeah.
Before we go, I've got to give you the world's worst news of the week, and I don't care about freedom of movement after Brexit. I don't care about free trade. I don't care about colour of my passport. I don't care about queues at the airports. But what I do bloody care about is Cadbury's chocolate, guys.
What?
And apparently, Cadbury's are having to stockpile their ingredients, their chocolate and their biscuits, in case of a no-deal Brexit.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
There were stories in Britain a few months ago about the government apparently stockpiling cans of food. And that was scary enough. But if you come for my chocolate, God damn it. But
dystopia's coming.
Yeah, they Mandela's have
warned. Is that what we're singing instead of holidays are coming? Dystopia's are coming. Dystopia's are coming. It's just Santa drinking meth out of a brown sack.
Eat chocolate that's like the budget brand advent calendar song.
Oh yeah, they're saying they're threatening higher prices and less choice if a Brexit deal isn't hammered out. Now, less choice sounds bad. I did go on the Cadbury's website before the show and hand counted the products listed on their Our Products page. There are 115 Cadbury's products. I reckon we could lose like fruit and nut and a couple of other things and not miss it.
So long as they don't come for the Oreo ones.
For the Oreo bars, yeah. Listen, if there's a Brexiteer listening, if anybody, if Dominic Raab, if Michael Barnier, you guys need to get around the table, because we're going to be so sad about everything else, we need our chocolate. Please fix this.
Yes, if we can't comfort eat after a no-deal Brexit, then we're done for.
The only reason I get through the first 4 months of the year is because mini eggs are back.
Yeah. Matt, where can people find out more about you and the various things that you do?
Oh, good question. Probably the most updated thing is Twitter, so at Matt Titan, just because, I'm on that every day. My website sporadically gets updated, which I think is probably most people, but that's MatthewHighton.com. And, otherwise, just I'm wandering around the sort of Kentish Town area, just come up, say hi.
Excellent. Meanwhile, we're all off to climb down a manhole and find either a mermaid or a snaking crocodile of trivia nerds.
Speak for yourself, I'm straight as a Mount Etna. I cannot die.
Bye.
Bye.
Do you want me to do it again?
Yeah.
From the other side.
Welcome to The Voice for
Robert Coates impersonators.
But what are the bad guys from Star Trek called?
Klingons.
Thank you. That's what you sounded like.
Great, I'm glad that you think I sounded like a Klingon.
You sounded like a fucking disco Klingon.
Maybe I said something really rude, in which case I'm really sorry to our Klingon listeners if I did.
I don't think SoundCloud reaches as far as the Klingon Empire.
Maybe it does, who knows?
Or the planet Klingon?
Oh, don't ask me.
Anyway, what else? I have no idea how it works in Star Wars.
If any of them have listened this far, you've really riled up the nerds.
Look, all I want to say to all of the Star Wars fans out there is Nanu Nanu. Okay?
Ben Vandervelde, who died today.
On Stardate 2175. Yeah.
On the galaxy far, far, far away. thanks so much to Matt for doing the podcast. Do go check him out, either doing his own stuff or go see Comedian Cinema Club. And that was our first episode that a podcast Patreon supporter suggested. Thank you, Catherine, for the topic. And if you want to join Catherine in having a chance to suggest a topic for us to do, we've got a few more lined up. Then go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/worstfootforward, where you can chuck us a couple of quid a month and get rewards varying from a shout out on the podcast to suggesting a topic to having us host a show in your very own home.
Yeah, and if you do want to suggest a topic, it's $5.
$5 a month, yeah.
Which is there a word for that in American slang? Is it a Benjamin? It's not a Benjamin.
I don't know what's on. Do they have a $5? No, they probably do.
No, I don't think they do. Maybe they do.
It's 5 Washingtons. Whatever it is, it's $5 a month or a couple of quid British.
Yeah, throw us a Reagan.
Yeah. they'll all be Trumps eventually, as we know. It's his face on everything. If you want to support us in other ways, well, you can do that visiting us on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you listen to the podcast and give us a little star rating and write a little review.
But the most important thing, subscribe. That is the dull drum I will be beating like a over-enthusiastic monkey from now until the end of time. If you've enjoyed our show but you haven't subscribed so far, do that. It is endlessly helpful to the algorithm that rules our destiny.
And you can also find us on Twitter at WorstFoot. Ben is on at Ben Vandervelde and I'm at BazMaxStay. And we're also on Facebook. And you can email us if you fancy, if 280 characters isn't enough for you. WorstFootForwardPodcast@gmail.com.
Who's coming next week? It is Helen McCarthy, who hosts a podcast called That's a Cult, which also sounds...
which you have to make sure you say properly.
Yeah, you do. My teeth are firmly in for that one. And we are going to talk about that very thing. We're going to talk about the world's worst cult.
If you want to prepare for it, do listen to some of Helen's episodes. You might have heard an advert for her show in a previous episode of ours. And she'll be joining us via Skype and indoctrinating us into the ways of the cult.
Yes, I mean, the reason she's joining us via Skype is because her cult leader prohibits interaction with the outside world.
So, join us then. Bye.
Bye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.